Hi, and welcome back to For the Medical Record, a podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Center for the Medical Humanities and Social Medicine. I'm your host, Mia Levinson, and I'm flying solo today for this special episode. I'm joined by Paul William Child, a professor of English at Sam Houston State University and an alum of our online master's program in the history of medicine. He's here to talk about his new book, The Dean Disordered, Jonathan Swift and Humoral Medicine, which examines how the chronic ailments of Irish satirist Jonathan Swift shaped his life and writings. This book actually grew out of the thesis project he wrote in the master's program, so I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk to him today. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Mia. Thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, so happy you're here. So just to get started, can you tell us a bit about how you came to this project? How did you get interested in Jonathan Swift?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And again, thanks for the invitation, because first of all, it gives me an opportunity to share the work that I've been doing for many years. It turns out that not that many people in my inner circle are all that interested in hearing me go on at length about my work. In fact, there's a running quip: if you want to clear out the faculty lounge in a hurry, just ask Child about his research. But I think the more important reason is that this has given me the opportunity to reflect upon the process by which this project evolved, how it was born, it grew in adolescent fits and starts, and then finally came of age in the book itself. I use the word project, and I think that's the way you framed the question too, but really it's been rather a long course of interest in life itself. In the early 1990s, I wrote a doctoral dissertation for a degree in English, a PhD in English, on George Cheney. And I don't know if you know him, but Cheney was an 18th century Scottish physician who was a doctor to the stars and lesser luminaries in London and Bath, and also a best-selling author. And so what I did is I looked at his medical writings as literature. Because it was a PhD in English, I did what a new critic might do. I looked at the structure and the characterization techniques and rhetorical strategies and that sort of thing. And now this is kind of commonplace, but in those days I had to make the argument from the outset that I was reading literature as literature. And in the 18th century, the notion of literature was, you know, anything written. But I had to make that argument theoretically because, you know, usually we look at canonical works like the plays of the kind you look at and, you know, poems and novels and that sort of thing. So I looked at him as literature. An important part of that process, though, was establishing context in medical history, understanding who the practitioners were, what their qualifications were, what claims they made to authority, especially at a time when the, quote, profession was a very wobbly and chaotic collection of all sorts of practitioners, from the learned physicians with Oxbridge degrees down to the wise woman next door, you know, who was peddling, who knew what. And one of the things I discovered was that many of these people made their claims through writing, especially after there was a licensing law that lapsed in 1695. And so many people had access to the press then that might not otherwise. And so people began making judgments about practitioners' authority based on what we now call literary style. You know, a quack, of course, would write in a low style, and a learned physician would write in a high style. But anyway, what happened was in establishing these contexts, I started into medical history itself in the most naive, roundabout, and accidental way. But this has given me a foothold. And then I got the, you know, a PhD in hand. I got a job at Sam Houston State University, as you mentioned, which is a regional state university in East Texas, about an hour north of Houston. And the reason this even matters in our conversation is that at a university like this, we were a teaching institution. The requirements for tenure and promotion through the ranks are not quite as challenging as they are at other institutions. In fact, I likely would not have a job at a research institution. But the good thing was, almost immediately, I was able to teach graduate courses in my specialty. In fact, my second semester, I had a grad course in 18th century literature. And then the other thing I think was more important, it gave me the leisure to work on this long-term study at greater length. I would not have been able to write this book on a tenure clock. It took 35 years. This is not to diminish my institution, but it did give me the leisure. And nowadays, by the way, people are required to write a book per rank. But the reason that's important to me is that I really did have more leisure than other people might have to assimilate the materials, do the legwork. One of our great librarians got Echo for me, the 18th century collections online, about 10 years ago. But before that, I had to get grant money to go to the British Library and look at primary documents. So, I needed more time to do this. And it demanded years of reading around, just sort of naively finding my way through. Now, you asked about the question in Swift, the interest in Swift itself, and that's the kind of question that's really hard to answer. I'm sure you found this with your own, you know, interest. But, you know, first of all, he is an important canonical author. I always tell my students that, you know, I would put him on the first string of the all-British, you know, basketball squad of great writers with Milton and Chaucer and Shakespeare. But I think also he suited my temperament. He's a great satirist who commonsensically asks questions about the world we live in the behavior and misbehavior of those around us. And also compellingly slippery and elusive, almost always speaking even about himself, ironically. So he was biographically interesting. Now, and not to go on too far but, you know, along with this, but my first scholarly interest was in how Swift might have represented medical matters. I guess we still call this interdisciplinary work, but I, that may be irrelevant because I tend to dissolve disciplinary boundaries. But first, I had an article about Swift, and this is kind of crude, his excremental cures. And then another one on medical satire, very clever medical satire he wrote. But not really about Swift himself. I've always been a little wary of biographical readings of works of literature, you know, because too often these become, you know, the way that the author represented her or his life in the work. So it becomes a sort of connect the dots between here are events in the author's life, here are the events in the. But eventually I did become more interested in Swift biographically, and I read all of his correspondence, five volumes worth, word for word, and found that he incessantly complained about his disorders. In fact, you know, to the point at which I was getting a little tedious. And his three disorders were, persistent chronic disorders, were what he called giddiness or vertigo. Increasing deafness began in one, I've forgotten which year, but then became bilateral. And also tinnitus, or as we might say, tinnitus, the ringing in the ears. And kind of collectively, these became orders that I found him representing in the works themselves. One thing I'm going to add, just because you asked the question about the process, but I could not have written this book as a young man. Not only because I needed time to assimilate and understand the medical history that I had no business being in it at one time, but also because increasingly his disorders, his deafness, and terrifying fits of vertigo isolated him from the social world, forced him to withdraw from the social world in which he thrived, and made him feel irrelevant. And I get that now. I understand what it must have been like for him to feel increasingly inconsequential, where he actually used that word, you know, just I feel I don't matter in the world. No, I think I matter. And my health is good. But I understand him now, what it's like to face frailties and be less consequential certainly in the world.
So you bring up the multitude of ailments that Swift suffered from. And in so many ways, this book is really responding to these claims that scholars and physicians have made throughout, you know, the past like century and a half, that Swift suffered from Meniere's disease, an inner ear disorder. And you make this claim in your book that Swift couldn't suffer from a disease that was not available to him. And I'd like to hear sort of your thoughts of like, what do you make of this problem of retrospective diagnosis now that you've worked on someone like Swift?
That's another great question, Mia. It's one that I kind of accidentally stumbled onto thanks to the medical history program there at Hopkins, especially a conversation with Mary Fassell, who directed the thesis. I'll start by saying there's certainly some value in retrospective diagnosis. You know, people in the modern clinic looking back on figures like Shakespeare and others, John Milton, and diagnosing their illnesses according to our own modern clinical terms, so both for biographers and also in my case for literary critics. For example, there's a recent article that came out about John Milton having suffered from a detached, let's say bilateral retinal detachment. Milton was blind. And this is interesting because it might suggest ways in which he could imagine light without seeing. And then, for example, if you've read Paradise Lost, you know, it begins, there is flame without, or there is it, fire without flame. So imagine the sensation of sight and light without actually having it. So anyway, I think there also, you know, it addresses interesting diagnostic riddles. But the problem comes with imposing our notions of disease and the body, especially upon a past that had very different notions of such. And here my medical training, my training in the master's program there at Hopkins helps. Just to give a little context here, Prosper Meunier, a French clinician, in 1861, looking for a pattern of illness among his patients, he was the director of the Blind and Deaf Institute in Paris. And he saw patients that, you know, as we say in the modern clinic, presented with this kind of constellation of what he saw as symptoms of vertigo, increasing deafness that began in one ear and then became bilateral, and then tinnitus, that's ringing of the ears. And they weren't, the problem with Meniere's disease, and I have a sister who suffers from this, so I know, it's very irregular, very episodic. In fact, the people who suffer from this have had real problems getting it passed through the ADA because, you know, do you really have this disorder if it just comes irregular? My sister's had three episodes in her entire life, and she's in her 60s, you know. Others have it chronically. But anyway, the problem is, you know, just defining this thing as a disease. But Meniere, what's the word we want to use, discovered this or created this or, you know, constructed it in 1861. And then in 1881, an English physician, John Bucknell, later Sir John, determined that that's what Swift had. And because he read Swift's correspondence and he heard the persistent complaints about these, you know, particular disorders. And almost without exception, that diagnosis has held with medical writers and biographers and, important to me, literary critics. And also it's the authority of the clinic that has held. And in the article, this famous article, which Bucknell diagnoses Swift with Meniere's disease, he crows about the victory, the triumph of the modern clinic over the benighted past of humoral medicine. They had no idea. Swift had no idea what he himself suffered from. And my response is, he knew exactly what he suffered from. His understanding of the body was that the body comprises four humors, and that his humors were out of balance. Now, I myself accepted this modern diagnosis with casual faith. You know, that's what he suffered from. In fact, actually, a couple of the articles that I wrote, you know, said with confidence, well, he suffered from Meniere's disease. And then, you know, realized I had the epiphanic moment when he was, oh, duh. He could not have suffered from a disease that didn't exist in his own day. But I think the more important part is that he didn't have the same body that the clinic understood. He had a very different conception of the body. And so that in mind, then I went back and, you know, historicized his body according to, try to get the understanding of the body as he himself knew it. And again, not to belabor this, but the way he understood his diseases, so he had these symptoms, you know, we now diagnose as Meniere's disease, but he understood that one of his four humors, phlegm, there was too much of it, and this is the thick, gluey, cold humor, and it, because he couldn't assimilate it, he couldn't digest it properly, it wasn't properly, quote, attenuated, it kind of accumulated in his head and stuffed his ears so he couldn't hear, threw off his equilibrium so he'd have these, you know, terrifying bouts of vertigo, what he called giddiness, usually. And the simple solution, of course, was if the body's out of order, you try somehow to put it back in order. And so he would eat food. He thought he had a cold stomach, so he'd drink a lot of wine. great excuse to, quote, warm his stomach and, you know, properly process the cold phlegm. And then also exercise. He was an obsessive exerciser. Well, you know, we might call him an exercise nut. He ran. He ran. He walked miles and miles every day. He swam, which would have been a very amusing sight in his own day in the river. And also his favorite exercise was to ride horses. I went to a trip to Ireland several years ago, and I got on a train from Dublin to Howth, which is out on the coast. And that's what he would ride daily. It was 25 miles, you know, out and back. And he would ride that every other day or so. So anyway, all that with an idea that he could shake loose the phlegm that was lodged in his head, and then that would wash out. So anyway, all this to say that I think the question was, well, so what? So we understand this. It's not simply an intervention matter of restoring him to his own body, but also understanding better how he might have represented that body imaginatively in his works. So one of the works, of course, is Gulliver's Travels. That's the work we know best. If we understand that he saw his own body disordered in a certain way, then I think we get a better sense of how his particular disorders, his hearing problems and his disequilibrium might have caused shifts in perspective. If you know Gulliver's Travels, you know, bodies are shrunk down and, you know, blown up, and there are weird sounds and, you know, everything, chaos, convergence of sensations. But I think we get a better sense of what Gulliver is going through, because that's what Swift himself went through. And there's one other thing I'd like to mention, because this is problematic, but Swift has a number of what we call scatological poems. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but the gross stuff. I always tell my students, make sure you haven't eaten lunch before you read these books. And many of them are about women and, you know, bodily functions and so forth. And so critics have had a field day. Some people see this, I mean, they're just out and out gross. But some Freudian critics see it as psychopathy. Like he was psychologically obsessed with such matters, and he's a coprophilic. Feminist critics have had a field day. You know, he's a misogynist, because many of the bodies that he represents are women. But I think if we restore these historically to the humoral understanding the body. We understand these are messy bodies, and they're doing what bodies do. Well, that begs the question, well, why women? Well, because women in the humoral tradition were thought to be, quote, moister. They don't just sweat and, you know, all the other bodily, but they also lactate. So Swift is writing the humoral body large here, the body that he knew and he tried to manage. And it's the men, the voyeurs, who are witnessing these humoral bodies and excreting and so on, that are really at fault because they fail to acknowledge those bodies, the very body that Swift himself every day was trying to put back in order.
I love that you bring up the scatological poems and the inclusion of fluids and like bodily functions that appear in Swift's writing, because it points to a key theme in your book, which is that it's not that you're trying to retrospectively diagnose or try to even come up with the singular term that encompasses all of Swift's ailments and then locate that within his writings. And more so, what you're doing is locating how Swift's own experiences of his body and his own understandings of health and medicine show up in his writings in the same way that, you know, I as like someone in the medical humanities as well is also thinking about how ideas about medicine, about health, about fitness are sort of arising in different forms of popular culture. And so, you know, me as someone who, you know, primarily works in 19th and early 20th century America, I found that this book had a lot to offer me as someone who's also thinking about disability studies. And one of the things that really caught me is that you make this argument that Swift was chronically ill rather than someone who was periodically sick. And you use both his personal writings and his imaginative works to illustrate how illness and disorder were part of his daily life. From your own readings of his correspondence, do you think that Swift saw himself as disabled by his chronic conditions? And what do you think identifying Swift as chronically ill does for the study of his writings?
Mia, that's another excellent question. Thank you for asking that. The problem with his particular disorders is they were persistent, and they started at a very young age. It's hard to date, but you know, somewhere in his late teens, maybe early 20s, certainly, when he experienced the giddiness and also the hearing disorders. But the problem early on, they were sort of irregular. I mean, he'd have an episode and then he thought he was cured. Pretty soon it became apparent to him that these were indeed chronic. And he finally said something like, you know, they'll get me before I get them. In other words, you know, this vertigo, will, you know, especially the giddiness was terrifying to him. So, you know, this is what's going to kill me. But they came in what the word that he uses again and again is fits. But he did accept the fact that he was chronically ill and that the best he could do is keep them at bay. And he even used a military metaphor in one of his court letters that, you know, he was sort of losing ground daily to this, actually puts it in terms of, you know, sort of military terms. But I think one thing, in the answer to your great question, is that the understanding of disability was certainly different. There wasn't, you know, people like Tobin Siebers has theorized disability, talks about disability communities and a disability identity. But the 18th century has a different notion. And I know this only secondhand by reading Daniel Turner, who's written about disability in the 18th century. And there wasn't a sense of a disability community per se or disability identity. So really it was more a matter of impairment, social impairment. So Swift's disability and what disabled him, as we might say, was that he felt increasingly isolated and confined. He said, "Well, I had to confine myself to my garden here." By the way, the subtitle of the book is "The Dean." I'm sorry, that's the title. "The Dean Disordered," because he was the dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was a clergyman in the Church of Ireland, and so he was often confined to the deanery there in Dublin. And often he would have to leave. He thrived on social life. In fact, he controlled conversations. He loved, you know, but he'd find he'd have to leave the room and deputize one of his friends to kind of take over the proceedings at the table. And so his disabilities then came as physical impairments, but also that increasingly isolated and confined and socially. And I think another part of it too, you know, that he had a very traditional sense of what we call masculinity. You know, men move in the world, men do things and important things in the world. And when he found himself confined and isolated by these disabilities, by his hearing disability, his vertigo, then he found himself confined to the domestic sphere and felt dependent upon his servants and his close friends and his other domestics, then he found himself, you know, weak and powerless. So that was a real issue for him. He prided himself on his athletic abilities, and in fact, he was always kind of goading his other male friends like Alexander Pope. You know, you need to ride more. You're hanging out at home too much. So your good question too about how he might have represented this, especially in Gulliver's Travels. Listeners have read book two. Gulliver is shrunk down. He's little. He's, you know, 6 inches tall. The Brobdingnagians, the giants, are 12 times his size. And there he feels helpless and dependent, and especially physically helpless and feeble and unable and silly. And I think that's the way Swift himself felt.
Yeah, I think that this idea of impairment, of not being able to participate in daily life, this isolation, like all these things that kind of come out through his writings that you identify in his correspondences, were just really fascinating to read. So we've talked about Swift's writings. As you said, you're a literary scholar, and yet you chose to pursue this master's degree in the history of medicine. What do you think pursuing historical study offered your own understanding of Swift and his works, especially since you had been immersed in this archive for so long? And do you have any suggestions for other literary scholars who are considering pursuing historical studies?
Well, thanks for that question too, Mia. As I said, most of my own medical history was entirely accidental, just because lit scholars looked at medical history as context and background. And I think, you know, one of the developments in the last 40 years or so has just been the kind of the disappearance of background. I mean, what we used to consider context has become what we study now. So part of it was just my own sort of reapportionment, or I don't know what the right word is here, but the sort of new way to look at medical history, not as merely context, but as, you know, the stuff that we grapple with. In some ways, the medical historians that I've encountered, the methods aren't all that different. I mean, you look at texts and you look at performances in the same way that we might look at a, you know, canonical work. But anyway, so my work was the result of accidental reading around in the field just because I needed context. What happened was, I've done very little strategic in my career. Just everything was accidental. Like, you know, yeah. But one strategic thing I did was that I'd been working with Swift, and I just Swift in medicine for years and years and years, and just globs of going nowhere. And then when I saw the advertisement for the online MA program at Johns Hopkins, and I realized that a thesis was required, I thought, aha, I work well under the guidance of other people. I'm not well self-directed. I could apply for the program, and then I would be forced to write a thesis that would help me put my book in order. And when I applied, I think I had to write a statement of purpose, and Mary Fassell responded very generously and kindly, as she does. Yes, we'd love to have you in the program. And by the way, I think I'll direct your thesis for you. So that was wonderful. But anyway, back to your central question. When I did get into the classwork itself, you know, sort of stumbled in naively, the formal training in medical history gave me a much more rigorous way to look at, to frame my own study of Swift and consider how his, you know, how to look at his ailments with a little greater sort of scholarly rigor that I had. And you know, also by looking at the way that medical historians work, not only Mary, but also Graham Mooney, who's another kind of key figure in my development there. So I think, you know, as Mary said, well, it gave you some chops. I guess that was the word. Yeah, I guess I can put it on my line item on my resume. But really, the training did suggest to me or force me to look at medicine and the way that I was considering medical history more rigorously. You asked the good question about how other people in, you know, literary scholars might consider historical studies, and I'll work with medical history just because that's what I'm working with. But one thing certainly that the study of medical history can enrich and layer the study of literature, partly by giving us more context, but also to understand how writers might represent their bodies and disorders imaginatively, even if accidentally. Again, I don't like that biographical reading. I'm always suspicious that, you know, this is what an author is representing. But often, especially in the case of someone like Swift, they're representing these things whether they want to or not, whether they mean to or not. So I think if we understand better the medical milieu and the medical history of the day, we get a better sense of how they understood their own bodies and how they understood their own disorders.
Whenever we interview scholars about their newly published books, we always like to ask, you know, we want everyone to go out and grab this book, but who is your ideal audience for this book? Who do you really want to pick up this book and read it? And what do you hope people will take away from reading The Dean Disordered?
I certainly think anyone with an interest in medical history, but literary scholars in general, Swift particularly, and, you know, one thing that consoles me occasionally is that there are a pretty fair number of people who are still interested in reading and teaching Jonathan Swift. So, you know, narrowly scholars of what we're now calling the long 18th century and so forth. And I think biographers too. Every single biographer that I've read since the late 19th century accepts that Swift suffered from this particular disorder. And I'm not asking that they overhaul their, you know, understanding of Swift, but certainly that they consider that we might historicize him as well. Now, I always joke to friends and family who you know, bothered to buy the book, or this is not a page turner. But I do think that there may be some interest still for general readers who have some kind of interest in famous figures of the past and how they negotiated their lives and how they negotiated, especially illness, because we all, you know, eventually we go the way of all flesh, right? So here was a man who wanted to be consequential in the world, tried hard to be. He was very ambitious, you know, and he tried to pretend that he wasn't, but he was. And he was stymied by these real physical issues in his life. And I think there's, so in that sense, I think, Mia, there's something in it, a little something in it for all of us.
Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. This has been a really great conversation. It was really great to hear more about your process and your experience with the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.